This program is produced and provided by lawyer Kyung-jin Kim.
So picture this. You are standing in the ancient city of Tainan, Taiwan.
Okay.
The air is thick and warm. It carries this sharp, sweet scent of burning incense from the nearby red brick temples.
Right. Very atmospheric.
Exactly. Street vendors are calling out. Bicycles are flowing in a steady rhythm. And there is just this undeniable feeling of safety.
It sounds incredibly peaceful.
It really is. But then the scene violently shifts. You are suddenly dropped into the heavy, suffocating humidity of Bangkok in the late 1960s.
Oh, wow. That is a massive tonal shift.
Yeah, it's jarring. U.S. bombers are literally tearing through the skies overhead on their way to neighboring countries. The streets are tense with political instability, and the shadow of the Vietnam War is creeping closer every single day.
It's a powder keg, essentially.
Completely. And then finally, the humidity vanishes entirely. It's replaced by this biting, freezing cold.
Wait, where are we now?
You are standing inside a dormitory in a Kentucky reform school. It's 1973.
Yeah.
There are no locks on the doors. There are no drawers for clothes. And in the harsh fluorescent light, a 9-year-old boy is surrounded by 100 rough, hardened teenagers.
Mm.
And he is quietly, methodically scrubbing their toilets.
The sheer distance there, both geographical and, you know, psychological, from the warmth of Tainan to the cold porcelain of a Kentucky reformatory is staggering.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, it is a whiplash of environments that would break almost anyone.
And the wildest part is that we aren't outlining some modern Charles Dickens novel here. This is the actual childhood of Jensen Huang.
Right.
That exact boy, the one scrubbing toilets, would go on to become a multi-billionaire, the CEO of NVIDIA, and arguably the chief architect of the modern AI revolution.
Which is just wild to think about. The author of the source text for our deep dive actually frames him as the Caesar of Silicon.
I love that title. And, you know, whether you are a tech enthusiast, an entrepreneur building a startup, or just someone who's fascinated by stories of impossible odds, our mission today is to show you exactly how a wandering boy's grueling trials forged one of the most resilient minds in business.
Because resilience is rarely an inherent trait, right?
Yeah.
It is manufactured. It's built under extreme pressure.
Yeah.
And to understand the mechanics of how a 9-year-old survives the chaos of a Kentucky reform school, we really have to look at the psychological foundation built years earlier back in Taiwan and Thailand.
So let's start there. Jensen was born in 1963. The family lived in Tainan. His father worked as a chemical engineer at an oil refinery, and his mother was a school teacher.
Just a standard, solid, middle-class life.
Exactly. They spoke Minnan, a traditional Taiwanese language. Uh-huh. But when Jensen was 5, his father's job transferred them to Bangkok.
And Bangkok, during the late 1960s, was an incredibly volatile place.
Right.
I mean, the geopolitical anxiety in Southeast Asia was palpable. As military activity escalated in Vietnam, Thailand became deeply unsettled.
And if you're a parent watching military transports and unrest right outside your window, the instinct to secure a safe future for your children just overrides everything else.
Absolutely. And Jensen's father had a very specific vision for that safety because years prior, he had traveled to New York for a worker training program at a Carrier air conditioning factory.
Oh.
Yeah. And that single trip exposed him to a vast, predictable abundance that he had just never seen before. So he decided right then his boys were going to the United States.
But having a dream to send your kids to America is common. Mm-hmm. Preparing them to actually survive there is a completely different operational challenge entirely.
Oh, for sure.
And this is where Jensen's mother steps in with a strategy that, honestly, on its face, sounds completely absurd.
It really does.
She knows the boys need to speak English, but the issue is she doesn't speak a single word of English herself.
Not a word.
Right. So her solution, she grabs a massive English dictionary. And every single day, she picks 10 random words.
Mm-hmm.
She makes Jensen and his older brother memorize them, spell them, and explain the definitions back to her.
Even though she had absolutely no idea if their pronunciation was correct.
Exactly.
She couldn't verify the definitions. She was operating entirely blind.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because from an educational standpoint, this sounds like terrible pedagogy.
Oh, a total nightmare for a linguist.
Right. I mean, it's like coaching someone to swim when you've never been in a pool yourself. You were just standing on the deck yelling, move your arms faster.
Uh-huh.
If she doesn't know the language, what is she actually teaching them?
Well, what's fascinating here is that she wasn't teaching them a language at all.
Oh.
She was installing a psychological framework that we might call modeled confidence.
Modeled confidence. Okay, explain that.
Think about the mechanism at play here. When a mother sits down, demands her children tackle an impossible task, and then responds to their efforts with absolute, unwavering belief that they have succeeded, she normalizes the act of conquering the unknown.
Ah, I see. So it wasn't about the vocabulary words.
Exactly. She wasn't grading their linguistic accuracy. She was grading their conviction. By projecting this executive presence and demanding they rise to meet it, she was basically rewiring her son's brains to reject limitations.
That is incredible. And Jensen later noted that this specific routine planted a seed of unshakable self-belief. It cemented his lifelong mantra, which is, how hard could it be?
And that engineered confidence met its ultimate stress test very quickly. Because as the war crept closer, the parents made an incredibly desperate high-stakes gamble.
Yeah, in 1973, they sold almost everything they owned. They bought tickets and put 9-year-old Jensen and his 10-year-old brother on a flight across the Pacific Ocean. Alone.
Just completely alone. They were heading toward an uncle they had never met in Tacoma, Washington.
Which is terrifying.
The level of trust required to put two young children on that plane, it just highlights the profound desperation of the era.
So they land in Washington, and this uncle is a recent immigrant himself. He is strapped for cash and scrambling to figure out what to do with these kids.
Right, because he works full-time. He can't just watch them.
Exactly. The parents sent a tiny bit of tuition money, so the uncle goes hunting for a boarding school. And he finds a glossy brochure for the Oneida Baptist Institute in Clay County, Kentucky.
Based entirely on these photos, he assumes it is an elite Eastern prep school.
Right, like ivy on the walls, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So he signs them up and ships them off.
I'm sitting here trying to picture doing this to my own kids today.
Yeah.
And it feels borderline negligent.
Well, sure, by today's standards. Mm-hmm. But we have to view this through the lens of 1973 information asymmetry. Today, you check Google Street View. You read forums. You verify accreditations. Back then, a recent immigrant had a piece of paper with some nice photos and a severe cognitive bias. He wanted desperately to find a prestigious prep school, so he believed the brochure.
And the reality was that Clay County, Kentucky was one of the poorest regions in the United States. Oneida was emphatically not a prep school.
Not even close.
It was an institution for troubled, marginalized youth. Kids who fell out of the regular education system were sent there.
Right.
So when Jensen and his brother arrived, they found a facility with no locks on the doors. Kids were openly smoking, carrying pocket knives, and getting into fights.
Dropping a sheltered 9-year-old from Taiwan into a 1970s Kentucky reform school it's like dropping a newly written line of code into a massive legacy operating system.
Wow. Yeah.
Nothing aligns. The syntax is completely wrong, the inputs don't match, and the environment immediately tries to reject the foreign object.
And it was even worse for Jensen because he was only 9. He was actually too young for the main institute's classes.
Oh, right.
So he had to walk alone to a nearby public elementary school, which just amplified his isolation even more.
So the obvious question here is why he didn't call his parents and beg them to bring him home.
Right, because he was geographically and economically trapped. International phone calls from rural Kentucky to Thailand in 1973 were astronomically expensive.
And his parents had liquidated their lives just to get him there. There was no safety net.
None. He realized very quickly that the only way out was through. So he started by tackling the mandatory manual labor.
Because the school didn't hire janitors, right?
Yeah.
The students maintained the facility.
Exactly. Jensen's older brother was sent to work on a local tobacco farm. But 9-year-old Jensen was assigned to clean the boys' dorm bathrooms. He scrubbed toilets for over 100 rough, angry teenage boys.
And he did it every single day?
Every day. And he never complained.
Let's look at the mechanics of why that matters. We could call this the baseline theory of resilience.
Okay, I like that. The baseline theory of resilience.
Right. Because if your baseline for a bad day is scrubbing 100 toilets for violent teenagers who might attack you at any moment, your entire metric for risk and stress is permanently recalibrated.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
Decades later, when NVIDIA's stock price drops 30% or a massive product launch fails, Jensen Huang doesn't panic. Compared to his baseline, a corporate crisis is just a math problem.
Wow. Yeah, the toilet scrubbing proved to him that his environment couldn't strip away his dignity unless he allowed it.
Exactly. Though the threat of violence was very, very real.
Oh, absolutely. Huh. In an NPR interview years later, he didn't sugarcoat the experience at all. He simply stated, quote, kids got hurt.
Yeah.
He was bullied, he was beaten up, and on his first night in the dorm, he met his roommate. Now, this wasn't another 9-year-old. This was a 17-year-old guy covered in tattoos and heavily scarred from knife fights.
It's terrifying for a kid.
literally lifted his shirt to show this 9-year-old his stab wounds on the first night.
The power dynamic is entirely one-sided there. You have a massive, hardened 17-year-old and a tiny, accented 9-year-old in a room with no locks.
But Jensen doesn't cower. He studies this terrifying roommate and discovers a hidden vulnerability. The 17-year-old is completely illiterate.
Wow.
So Jensen brokers a deal. Here's where it gets really interesting, because you can look at this like an early high-stakes venture capital deal.
Okay, how so?
Well, Jensen identifies a profound market deficit, illiteracy. He offers a highly specialized service, teaching him to read, and he takes his equity in the form of physical protection from the rest of the dorm.
That is a fascinating framework. He found the one currency he possessed that the giant lacked.
Yeah. But wait, actually, I have to push back on my own VC analogy here.
Why is that?
Because a venture capitalist has a legally binding contract. A 9-year-old has absolutely nothing. If I am a 17-year-old hardened delinquent, once I learn the alphabet, why wouldn't I just go back to bullying him? How did Jensen actually enforce this contract?
He enforced it through the mechanism of daily mutual vulnerability.
Mutual vulnerability.
Yeah. Think about the actual process of a 9-year-old with a Taiwanese accent trying to teach English phonetics to a Kentucky teenager.
It sounds incredibly difficult.
It requires breaking down words syllable by syllable, sitting shoulder to shoulder every single night. For a 17-year-old gang member to admit illiteracy to a child requires dropping his armor entirely.
I see.
As they worked through the mechanics of language together, the transaction evolved into a genuine human bond. The roommate actually taught Jensen how to bench press.
Oh, that's right.
He kept him safe, not because of a contract, but because Jensen offered him the dignity of education without judgment. Jensen learned to look past a terrifying exterior and locate the universal human desire to improve.
That is super powerful. But, you know, he was figuring out how to survive, sure, but he was also just the kid trying to navigate the social hierarchy.
Oh, yeah.
He actually tried taking up smoking for a brief period because everyone else in the dorm was doing it.
Right, just trying to fit in.
Exactly. But his internal pragmatism kicked in. He realized cigarettes cost money, and he preferred spending his limited cash on ice cream and snacks at the commissary. So he just quit.
Which is so funny, but it reveals a core operating principle he still uses today, which is calorie-based cold cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah, ice cream over cigarettes.
Exactly. He wasn't swept away by the emotional current of peer pressure. He evaluated the return on investment, found it lacking, and pivoted his strategy.
So practical. And during all this, his only connection to his previous life was through cheap cassette tapes.
Because phone calls were still out of the question.
Right. So his parents bought a cheap recorder. Jensen and his brother would spend a month recording messages. They'd mail the physical tape across the Pacific, and his parents would record their voices over the same tape and mail it back.
Those tapes were really the mechanism for maintaining a shared reality. Despite the intense isolation, he could still report back on the American dream his father had promised, even if it looked drastically different than the brochure.
Well, he did find glimpses of that dream. Like, he went to a McDonald's for the first time, and it just blew his mind.
Oh, I bet.
He actually recorded a message to his parents saying the restaurant was glowing, it was like the future, and the food came in perfect little boxes.
Coming from a chaotic, dirty dormitory, the sterile perfection of a McDonald's hamburger must have felt like an alien artifact.
Seriously.
McDonald's represented exactly what his father saw at the Carrier factory years earlier. Systemic, predictable abundance. In an environment defined by chaos and danger, a perfectly uniform burger in a perfectly uniform box is a beacon of order.
That's such a great way to put it. It was proof that his parents sacrificed everything for actually existed somewhere outside the walls of his dorm.
Exactly.
He also found an escape through sports, specifically table tennis. And he didn't just play casually, he completely dominated.
Right, because he was a small, skinny kid in a world where physical size usually dictated your rank. But at the ping pong table, his physical stature was irrelevant. If we connect this to the bigger picture, table tennis is the perfect mechanical metaphor for his subsequent business philosophy at NVIDIA.
Oh, health.
Ping pong is not a game of brute force. It is a game of physics and microseconds. It requires analyzing the Magnus effect on a spinning ball, reading the micro expressions of your opponent, and anticipating the trajectory before the paddle even makes contact.
You win by outmaneuvering a giant.
Exactly. Making them react to your spin rather than fighting their power directly. And Jensen applied himself to this with absolute obsession.
He mastered it to the point that he was featured in Sports Illustrated by age 14.
That's incredible.
He literally learned to predict where the ball was going to be, not where it was.
Which is NVIDIA's entire strategy in a nutshell.
Exactly. And eventually, the wandering did come to an end. After two brutal years in Kentucky, his parents secured the means to immigrate. They moved to Beaverton, Oregon, and finally pulled the boys out of Oneida.
The reunion was joyful, of course, but the boy who arrived in Oregon had been fundamentally rewritten by his environment. He had survived the crucible, but the daily reality of immigrant life remained really harsh.
Yeah, his father scoured newspaper ads for any engineering jobs he could find. His mother worked odd jobs. Jensen remembers the sheer despair on his mother's face when a piece of cheap rented furniture broke apart in their apartment.
Because they were just living on the edge.
Exactly. But the skills Jensen forged in Kentucky transferred perfectly to this new life. He skipped two grades. He graduated high school at 16. He dominated math and computer clubs.
He essentially applied the ping pong strategy to his academics. Anticipate the system, outmaneuver the competition, and just outwork everyone else.
And he had internalized the absolute certainty that the world is chaotic and often unfair. But if you relentlessly hone your specific skills, you can dictate the terms of your own survival.
Which brings us to a really fascinating piece of philanthropy. In 2019, long after he became a billionaire, Jensen Huang donated $2 million to the Oneida Baptist Institute. He built Jensen Huang Hall, which is a brand new dormitory and classroom building for girls. So the boy who scrubbed their toilets ended up financing their architecture.
That is poetic. And it shows he doesn't view Oneida through a lens of bitterness or trauma.
Not at all. He views it as the forge that tempered his mind. Building a dormitory specifically for girls, arguably the most vulnerable demographic in an underserved educational system, shows he understands exactly what kind of sanctuary was missing when he was there.
He actually gave a commencement speech at Stanford where he leaned into this entire philosophy. He looked at a crowd of elite, highly optimized graduates and said, quote, "I wish upon you ample doses of pain and suffering. Greatness comes from character, and character is formed out of suffering."
It's a heavy message for a graduation.
It is. And so what does this all mean? I want to challenge that idea a bit. The author compares him to Emperor Augustus, who also survived brutal early trials to build an empire. Does suffering inherently create greatness, or does an inherently great person simply possess the tools to survive the suffering?
Well, that is the eternal tension of nature versus nurture, right?
Yeah.
But if we synthesize his entire trajectory from the incense of Tainan to the geopolitical dread of Bangkok to the freezing doorless dorms of Kentucky and finally to the struggles in Oregon, the mechanism of his success becomes really clear.
What's the mechanism?
He wasn't just crossing oceans. He was continuously crossing the boundaries of his own perceived limitations. The trauma failed to break him because his mother had already installed the software of absolute confidence.
Dictionary lessons.
Exactly. Instead of destroying him, the suffering became his ultimate competitive advantage. It was the verified proof that he could be dropped into the most hostile environment imaginable and systematically figure out how to thrive.
It is a remarkable progression.
Yeah.
I mean, going from a 9-year-old brokering literacy for physical protection with a tattooed teenager to architecting the hardware that powers global artificial intelligence.
It really is. And this raises an important question about our current cultural operating system. Because today we spend immense resources trying to perfectly optimize our lives, right? We design frictionless environments and we work obsessively to shield ourselves and our children from discomfort, failure, or just raw adversity.
We do. Helicopter parenting, all of that.
Exactly. Yet when we deconstruct the origin story of one of the most innovative and resilient minds of the century, his defining superpower was forged entirely in the fires of unavoidable hardship.
That's so true.
It asks us to seriously consider, in our relentless quest to engineer all the struggle out of our lives, what kind of greatness are we accidentally preventing from taking shape?
That is a profound thought to sit with. Keep that in mind the next time you find yourself desperately trying to smooth out every single bump in the road for yourself or your kids. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the early years of Jensen Huang. Keep exploring the hidden mechanisms behind the world around you, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.
This program is produced and provided by lawyer Kyung Jin Kim.